band is called Midnight Oil. They're from Australia. I don't know what the song's about, honestly. But I think it was about, I watched the video. The dude's like dances like Mick Jagger, like weird like that, you know?
Yeah.
And they're out in the, like, the Aboriginal desert. I don't know. I think it's about something like the environment and giving it back to the Aboriginal people. So,
anyway. Yeah.
But I like the song. It's called Beds Are Burning. You might remember it from back in the day.
I do remember.
Anyway, joining me today, it's been a while, Tim Lynch and Jeff Kenny of the Kenny and Lynch partnership here. So, Timmy, how you doing? How's life?
Man, life is just fine, Mac. Thanks for having us back on.
No. Always enjoy the conversation. Jeff, what's
very
going
good.
On?
Very good. Glad to be here. Appreciate
all right.
it, man.
All right. I'm trying to think. I want to talk about cyber warfare today, a little bit anyway. I had a Marine, so one of the things I talk about when we do post-traumatic winning, I talk about meditation. I say, we talk about wellness practices, and wellness practices you have to develop in order to handle, you know, what I call my black blood, that blood that, you know, percolates inside of you, the blood you kill with, right? So when you have trauma inside you and then there's things that activate it, you have to have ways to deal with that. And whether it's music or animals or, or physical activity, you know, everybody's got to find that, right? But the problem with all that stuff is it's not deployable. So, you know, I said, look, you don't got to be a genius to conclude in pretty short order that you better have something akin to meditation. And I said, but we need to find a different word for it, because if you say you're meditating, everybody's going to go, whatever, dude. But if we, like, you know, everybody's into CrossFit. So if we call it, like, I'm doing CrossMind, be like, oh, right on, man. Get some. But so you got to find a way to, you know, it's a warfighting tool, man. A way to settle your brain down, to calm down, to get clear a little bit, and clear your head when you're doing stuff. I mean, come on, that's like, you got to be able to do that, because especially if you're a leader, because that's your number one weapon is your brain. And so, in the midst of that, we're at EWS, and during the break, Captain comes walking up, and he introduces himself, and he says, "Sir." He said, "I just wrote a paper on, you know, meditation as a combat multiplier." I said, "What?" He said, "Yep." I said, "Will you send it to me?" And so it just so happens that so he comes on the program on Monday, and we're talking. And I said, "Okay, so what do you do in the Marine Corps?" He said, "Well, I started out in communications, and then there was opening in like the cyber field, so I got into that." And then just within the last year, I was accepted into a different MOS, and now I'm a space cyber warfare guy. I was like, exactly, I was like, whoa. Do you have your own special uniform for that? He's like, give the Spock salute and all that? He's like, nope. I'm like, I mean, like, who's cooler than you, man? Cyber in space? He's like, I knew this was going to happen. And I said, well, come on. And I said, okay, so, but I've never interviewed a cyber guy because they won't come on, right? I said, could you explain cyber to me? Because I don't get it. Okay, so we're going to have cyber Marines. Where do they exist? What do they do, right? Because that stuff is held at, you know, pretty high levels. So Marines are now cyber Marines. Do they exist in the meth?
Mm-hmm.
Do they exist in the regiments? Like, where do they exist? I said, could you explain that? And he says, yes.
It's time.
And so he said, look, think of those guys as fires guys, right?
Right.
You want to have a certain effect. And so there's going to be, he said, you know, they'll be in the math. He said, but regiments aren't going to have cyber guys.
Right.
He said, so if you think of it as having an effect on a certain area, then that would be your best. So you're going to have planners, guys who help you plan cyber, and then it's obviously got to be cleared, and that's how really it's going to work. So you may want a certain effect. He said, but I think what you're saying, Mac, was you may not be able to get that effect because of some other competing higher priority, like a fire mission, so your request would be denied. And because it is controlled at the highest levels. And I said, oh, all right. So not everybody gets, one mortar tube and two machine guns. He said, no, not everybody can have cyber. So, and then I went back to that thing that Zinni says in those Zinni tapes, like about deception. Not everybody can do deception because at Austerlitz, if the guy that was in the wasn't in the fog wanted to make the other Gomer believe that he was in the fog, that would have screwed up Napoleon's plan. And I said, so I have the kind of same feeling about cyber. So, anyway, I share that with you to ask you this. Thoughts on cyber?
Well, Tim, you got anything? Because I got some stuff.
Timmy?
No, I was just going to say, I was fascinated when I was listening to you talk to you and thought of, I didn't know anything about it, and I'm writing a book, and I'm stuck, and I was stuck on needing something to get my narrative forward, and attaching a cyber warfare officer to the character to give him supporting fires from on high, man, you can make a hell of a story out of that. Just think about it. It's amazing to think that these guys are deployed out with tier one hitters. But yeah, so I really appreciated you talking to that kid because I was like, whoa. I spent hours writing after I listened to that yesterday.
Are you kidding me? You are.
No, absolutely. Absolutely right there. I've been stuck for like 3 weeks. I know where I want to go. I didn't know how to get there, and a guy, actually, it will, because it's a story, so you want to be published, it will be a girl. But with that capability, they're attached in this story for a character that basically is Mattis. I'm telling you, that you can do a lot with that, and most of what you're thinking about is probably pretty close to true, because, I'm just trying to figure out how this would work, right?
Right. It's mostly defensive, like in the meth, they're more worried about cyber attacks than we are prosecuting them. And the people who are prosecuting it, it's real secret squirrel stuff, So.
Yeah, again, I don't enough about it. Jeff would know more than I, but you read all this stuff.
Well, I mean, like, how they messed up the Iranian nuclear plan was through cyber attacks here a few years ago.
Yeah, and, but I thought that was the Israelis.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Yes. Israelis, and then some people in DOD tried to horn in on the credit for it. But you're right; it was mostly the Israelis, and I think anybody who. Most of the good stuff gets done by people who have the most to lose if they fail, and that defines Israel right there, So, they were the ones who pretty much did it, but we had some hand in it.
Right.
Or at least we allowed it to look like we did,
And I've also read that we're going to get out of the purely defensive posture because at some point
there
has to be a cost to this. I mean, look, is that not warfare on another nation? Nothing to see here. It was just cyber. Well, I mean, what the hell? I mean, the Chinese are raiding, right, our military technology via cyber. Is that, at some point, doesn't that become an act of war?
Yeah. And, but it's because it's in the realm of, it's not in the realm of actual kinetics. It's hard for people to define it. And then there's nobody who has their fingers into our stuff now more than the legal profession. And so you get into that stuff too. But I have to tell you, it's connected. In history, it used to be part of IO. Like before we did the Normandy invasion.
Hold on. Explain IO.
It's information operations, information warfare.
And how would that work? Go ahead and do the example before Normandy.
The example is the United States Free Press. One of the papers in Chicago, and Timmy knows this, I bet, printed shortly before D-Day that we're going to no shit land in Normandy in early June. I mean, this was like in April or May, and prosecute the war in Northern Europe from there, which is, of course, exactly what we did. Now, Roosevelt got approached by, Bill Donovan and J. Edgar Hoover and those guys then, and they said, hey, should we go after these guys? And he's like, I think if we do anything, it'll just confirm that we're going to do it. Are we willing to change everything that we've been planning just because of this? If we ignore it, it'll look like it's not true. It's just one more yellow rag, one more yellow piece of yellow journalism. So that's what they did. And of course, it helps to have an insane enemy like Hitler, who is convinced it was the Pas de Calais, even a month after he landed in Normandy, and he convinced it was all a big fake. But that's part of that. And so I think now you fast forward, 80 years later almost, and you got, or 70 some years later, and you got the Israelis doing that to the Iranians, messing up their nuke plants, mm-hmm. just like they did when they found out the Iraqis were doing it. And what year was that? It was like early 80s.
Yeah, it was 80s when they smoked their reactors, right? They just bombed them.
They bombed them, right? Now they're like, hey, if we bomb them, we bomb Iran, you got to make it count, because then you're at war with a country with a huge population, and, they think that's inevitable, but they don't want it to come just yet.
That was one of my, it was part of my rationale about not going to war in Iraq. And I said, look, this is just my opinion, okay? But if Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, who would be up his ass? It wouldn't be us having this very public and slow debate about it. It would be the Hebrews. They would be so in his shit, and that's why I don't believe it. They would not allow it. They didn't allow it.
Well, but he had used it. He had used it just 10 years before on his own folks.
Well, yeah, but again, yeah, but
he didn't have nukes, though, for
right,
sure.
He didn't have nukes. So, so to me, that's why I thought, because if the Israelis, right, that's a one-and-off event. They can't uh-huh. lose, and they don't screw with that stuff, right?
No, they didn't just do that, bombing that place. The name escapes me now. But there is a guy named Gerald Bull, Canadian dude, who was a specialist in making the high velocity cannons where you could actually shoot rounds into space, he made one for the Iraqis and he was going to make another one. And he just loved to make these big guns, right. And the Israelis killed him,
or he died of certain circumstances. Yes.
I think he died of 9mm rounds in the back of the head, but in his hotel room, but they killed him, and so you're right. I'm just reinforcing what you said about they don't screw around. So
yeah. So when people are making that argument, I'm like, let me tell you, right? The Jewish state does not mess around, right? Right. But before we will ever lay a glove on him, they will destroy him because it's not a clue. It's not a fair fight when the Israeli Air Force decides they're going to get after somebody, and there's nothing that the Iraqis can do. And the Israelis wouldn't stand for it. So, to me, anyway, that was part of my rationale.
Yeah.
Timmy, thoughts?
No. I'm with you both on it. I do remember that Gerald Butler guy, the largest cannon in the world. That was a weird damn piece of gear that guy was mm-hmm. building. I remember that from back.
He was behind the whole technology between rocket-assisted projectiles. The wraparounds. And the idea
right,
being
right.
creative. You create a vacuum in front of the projectile, and that yanks the without messing at all with the original deflection on the gun. It doesn't push the round from behind. It creates a vacuum in front, which pulls that projectile dead on the same azimuth that was already flying on. So he had this thing where he basically injected rocket explosions at junctures in this thing, which would cause this and allow the projectile to go ungodly distances. Yeah.
Interesting.
No, it was interesting. But the thing was, what you're saying about judging the legitimacy of the threat from Iraq based on the Israeli response. You know, back in 2003, I didn't see it that way. I recall being all about going in there. I remember showing up in Kabul in 2005 and telling the Afghans I was meeting, hey, man, we got this. We're going to have this place wired up. Everything's going to be just great. And I cannot believe when I look back at myself now after all these experiences, I cannot believe I actually thought that. I feel like an idiot.
I know. It's humiliating.
Well, you know what? I remember not knowing, what to think. My initial thought was, wait a minute, we can contain the Soviet Union for 50 years, and we can't deal with this idiot? And so that was my initial thought. And then I read the Zinni, the article that appeared, the interview with General Zinni in Salon magazine. Not exactly, I'll admit, not exactly a conservative bastion, Salon, but... I read that, and it was quintessential Zinni. And he went down the list. He said, look, these are the things that you can do in CENTCOM. These are the top eight, and it ain't in the top eight. And of the top eight, you can only fund five. Right. And they asked about WMD. He said, look, he has elements of systems that someday maybe might be connected. But that is not a threat to the United States.
Yeah, but still, Mac, it is a threat to the United States because we weren't really worried about existential threats to destroy our infrastructure. We were worried about somebody doing something like what happened on 9-1-1, 9-11. I can't remember what it really is. Someone doing something like that with a big bomb. And because remember, there's an anthrax attack at the same time.
I think that's revisionist history.
No, that you're doing.
No, because I would tell you when you look at what Wolfowitz and what those guys wanted to do, they wanted to tip over a moderate Islamic state and rebuild it in our likeness. And so I think all the circumstances.
Yeah, but they didn't tell us that. And to me, I don't know about you guys. But I could give a shit about weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein was a evil jerk, who had already done, and I mean, the way I looked at it was once the gloves were off after that attack in September 11th, I thought, so now none of these son of a bitches is safe. And we're going to go after this guy because he's one of the recent dickheads, and we're going to pummel him. And who cares? Where we fell off was, of course, not in the actual taking down of Iraq. And you're right, that was their plan, but they didn't publicize that to anybody. It didn't come out until later.
What Zinni talked about was he wasn't the threat that people were making him out to be. And I mean, look, let me tell you, everything I saw of Tony Zinni, and there's a reason I call him the Burning Bush. If that guy's saying that, then I would hit the pause button.
I agree with most of that, but I don't think of him that perfect. I thought he was kind of like one of these Philly East Coast liberals, with a lot of his thinking and stuff. I like to have huge staffs because when you're doing these humanitarian things, you never know what job's going to pop up. And I remember him having an argument with General Christmas about flax and helmets. Because I thought to myself, these two guys are both victim of their experiences. Because Zinni had two tours in Vietnam. One is an advisor, 64, 65, right, or thereabouts, and then one is a company commander, 1970, right, with 1-5. And he was the CEO of the same company Webb was in earlier. James Webb was in earlier. Delta 1-5. And so his experiences were all about humping in the jungle.
Where did 1-5 operate in 1970?
In 1970 in the Anwa Valley. But the war had been starting to wane down by 19. It wasn't the same intensity. And General Christmas, I have to tell you, I much prefer General Zinni to General Christmas. But General Christmas's idea of Vietnam was totally different.
Right.
He had that one tour in Vietnam, right. And basically he was fighting in the Battle of Arnhem all over again. You know, he's an us to house guy, and to him,
only for Tet, and then he got wounded and then he went home during Tet. I mean, they were down fighting the Viet Cong right in the coastal region, and then they went to during Tet, they went to Hue, and he gets wounded at Hue, and he leaves. But the reason I ask is one of the things I've learned, and Tim's dad and his uncle have been instrumental in this for me. And what you say is right. And I remember Zinni saying that in that PME. He said, you know, I don't really like to talk about my combat experiences that much because, you know, as the years go by, you know, I don't know that we remember it the way it was. Maybe we remember it the way we want to remember it. And maybe we see a cause and effect relationship where there wasn't a cause and effect relationship. And I thought, that's pretty interesting. And so, I mean, he's always been interested to me. But the thing that Timmy's dad and his uncle, you know, have taught me about Vietnam is so different depending on what year you were there, right? And what geographically, right? 1966, 67, 68, up by the DMZ, Thunderdome, man. Leatherneck Square, you were fighting the NVA, and they would come and get your ass and yoke your shit up, right? In those same years, if you were fighting down by on the coastal plain, you were fighting the Viet Cong before Tet when they got bled white. Post Tet, right, there was no Viet Cong, right? And the NVA had been bled white. So by the time Zinni goes back in 70, and I'm not denigrating anybody, but the North Vietnamese Army had been hammered. And it would take them till 71 into 72 to get built up enough to push again. And so really, really interesting.
I agree with you 100%, by the way, on that little vignette you just said about the differences about when and where is absolutely true. We pulled last Marine battalions out of there. The last battalion out was 3-1 in May of 71. And you're absolutely right. And the NVA got their shit back together. They turned themselves into one of Zhukov's, corps and blitzed them in 1972 just the way the Soviets would have done it.
Right. Timmy, you've been uncharacteristically quiet.
No. I like listening to you and Jeff talk, quite frankly. I enjoy that part. But
I
listen to
you talk. Especially when you're writing your dad and your uncle,
I'm just taking it all in. Yeah, the 72, they did reconstitute themselves, got their ass kicked by the Cobras, though. They didn't know about toes. They lost so much armor, the Soviets were like going to cut them off. They got their asses kicked pretty good by us.
We want to lose tanks. We'll just give some more to the Egyptians. You guys are supposed to be better than that.
Yeah.
and you know what the NVA says? Like, we had it all figured out except that goddamn bridge at Dong Ha. Like, what happened there? Right?
Yeah, he should have. I mean, I'm not a, you know, you always wonder about how they do the decorations thing, but if ever was there was a Medal of Honor, man. You know, on so many levels, that was a tactical thing he did that had strategic consequences for the enemy.
Supposedly, the army dude that was there would not write an eyewitness statement about him.
Huh.
Oh, no way. I didn't know that was the deciding factor.
The tank guy?
Yep.
But he was that's weird. I wonder why. Maybe somebody leaned on him. Who the hell knows?
Somebody leaned on him. But the story of the Dong Ha Bridge, John Ripley up there, and I found some audio of Ripley and talking, and I read the eulogy that his son gave at his funeral, and it's awesome. It's awesome, like growing up as John Ripley's kid, right? Ripley's just, I think there's a book, the book is entitled like American Knight or something like that, about Ripley, And, you know, his son said, his son was a Marine officer. I think a couple of them were. And he said, there was.
Yeah, he put his son through IOC after you guys left.
Whoa.
No. Yeah, I was still there. I left.
Do you remember?
Yeah. I remember.
He said, there's two seats on the Ripley train, on it and under it.
Yeah.
And he said, other than that, you know, my dad was, you know, the guy he was. But, you know, other than that, we were a normal family. I remember driving up. From I don't know if it was North Carolina or Quantico to Martha's Vineyard, and we got there at about 2:15 in the morning, and we went straight into the ocean, and we had a family swim. So we did all the things that normal families did. We went swimming in the Atlantic Ocean in the summer at 2:15 in the morning. But his eulogy about his father is awesome. But when you hear that story of this offensive in 1972, and they've got tanks, and they're going to roll the whole nation,
right.
And Ripley blows that bridge, and he talks about doing this prayer, Jesus, Mary, help me, like something like that, as he's swinging underneath on the girders and putting explosives like into the bridge. And
using his Ranger handbook.
Yeah, I mean, it's like they get it. And the problem is, like, the TNT is old and not,
and
most of it's like grade 4, and we don't use anything, or like grade D, we don't use anything below grade B.
I think that Army, his name is Smock, and he was like, he wasn't doing any of the exposed gymnastics that Colonel Ripley. He's like helping him set the charges up and stuff. Yeah, it was an amazing thing. Yeah. You know, he came and I guess you were still there then, Tim, when he spoke at graduation. And me and Mel were out doing something. We came back to the bullpen after graduation, like around 10 in the morning, and he was in there and he's pushing that book about 3-3 in Vietnam, No Shining Armor. And he was more interested when he was talking to lieutenants and IOC about his time as a company commander, India 3-3. And one of the companies in 3-3,
what year?
It was 67. And they're up there, and his guys, you know, Getlin, we were talking about Getlin a couple of podcasts ago, the guy
where
Buffalo got the Medal of Honor, you know. They cleaned that site up. They're the company that went in there.
Afterwards?
Yes. Yeah, it was Colonel Ripley's company. And you had guys nailed to trees by NVA. Like, I think the radio operator for the company commander.
Well, you know, it's interesting. As I've learned more about that,
right.
That battalion, so it would have been 3-9 when in the Battle of Gitlin's Corner, they sent another company, same place, to execute the same mission, and they got their heads kicked in too, and that got the battalion commander and the ops so relieved, and then I want to say the battalion rotated out. And then that's probably when 3-3 came up. And then it said, because finally, when somebody got their act together and said, hey, they've done this here and this here and this here, well, when next time we go up there, we're going up there with the kitchen sink, and we're going to hand them their head, and that's what they did.
That book is pretty good. I had it years ago, I remember, but it talked about Ripley's company tour there, you know, 3-3. And then the last part of it was talking about North and his platoon and that company that he was in, because he also was in 3-3 in 69, though. He was there like 2 years after the same shit, hump your ass off and get attacked by 2000 NVA in the middle of the night, so it was very good. But Ripley was there, and he talked to me and Mel about it, and while he's talking to us, we were still all camming up from, I think we were doing PECs, in walks Etor, right? And so he had us transfixed there for like 3 hours. Colonel Ripley, that's when I first met him.
I love those things. When you teach to IOC, sometimes these things just happen.
Right.
I remember a guy named Keith Wells showed up one day.
Yeah, he was the Iwo Jima guy.
I remember that.
I remember Timmy was in the library when I got a phone call. I don't know, I answered the phone, and And it was the adjutant, and they said, "Hey, Mac, we've got a guy coming out here who was a platoon commander on Iwo Jima. Would you guys like to talk to him?" I was like, "Yeah." So we busted out the maps, right, and we went into the library, and he told us these, I mean, he told us these crazy stories of,
sure.
That was his first fight was Iwo Jima, and he was a big dude.
Yeah, Keith Wells, yeah.
Yeah, and he talked about, he talked about.
He was a platoon commander of both flag raisers. You know,
right,
both.
Right. And so their job was to cut across the island on day one, and they did. And he said about halfway across the island, we run into this huge pillbox, and, you know, we can hear all these Japs inside of us. So we got set up outside, and I took a thermite grenade, and I threw it through the opening, and that thing went off. And then he said the door opened. You could hear screaming and yelling. The door opened, and the smoke billowed out, and here they came. And he said you couldn't see them, but you could see their feet in those little those tabby boots, right?
Yeah.
And he said they were all holding the guy's bayonet scabbard in front of them. So the thing that holds your bayonet is a scabbard, right? So they're holding that from the guy in front of it, and he said, and I stood back, you know, about 5 yards, and there was about 13 of them, and I laid them out for inspection with my Thompson submachine gun. He said that. I laid them out for inspection. I was like, holy shit.
And on his deathbed, he was probably dreaming of that and smiling. I would be.
And then he talks about getting to the far side of the island on day one. And it's like, you know, on all our maneuvers and stuff, you know, we put wire out in front of us. He said, so, he goes, you know, there was Japs everywhere. And I get out, and I'm bouncing wire in front of our position. Bang, bang. And I get mine out, and I get it done, and I hop back in my hole. He said both of the platoon commanders went out and did that. One of them got shot and killed. The other one got shot and wounded.
Mm-hmm.
And Wells.
I guess that was like a lieutenant thing.
Yeah.
For that guy.
Yeah. And then he said, then I felt bad because in retrospect, that was the only night we ever did it. Because you simply could stand up like that on Iwo Jima. It's just one of those wonderful experiences that you had working there of some guy coming through Quantico, and he's a piece of Marine Corps and American history, and Keith Wells was one of them. So was John Ripley. When you read about the Bridge of Dong Ha, you're just like, this is comic book stuff, man. This is not. The interesting thing in the interviews that he does is, you know, he says that he passed out. He was up in the bridge, and he had, like, knees on girders and hands on girders, and And he said, I blacked out, and I woke up, and I didn't fall. And he said, I don't know how that happened. And so it's a crazy.
Because he was in tremendous shape. I mean, the guy's a.
Yeah, he's a.
Yeah, he had to be. Talk about a CrossFit challenge.
Oh, yeah, man. That's like how do you get yourself in shape to do that? You know, I saw him. I didn't meet him, but we saw him in 8th Marines and 2nd Marines and 6th Marines. We had officer PMEs in these big comm buildings down in Lejeune. And Colonel Smith, Etul Smith, was 8th Marines. He like, sponsored it. And Colonel Ripley came. He was 2nd Marines. And Larry Livingston, with 6th Marines, and they were the three guys who got the Navy Cross during the as advisors during the Easter thing. And so they talked about, you know, and I remember General Smith said, okay, we're going to do this chronologically, and he talked a little bit about how the South Vietnamese were. He said, like, first we started out in 1959 with a company or whatever it was in the 50s, a company of Marines, and pretty soon we had enough. So we have two companies, and then after a while we had a battalion, you know, we made a battalion out of it. Of course, now what we do is make the headquarters, and if we had any Marines left over, we'd make the, you know, the outfit out of it. But, and then he said, you know, how he ended his thing was, but what saved my personal ass in 1972 in Easter was John Ripley blowing up that bridge and bottling all those guys up. And then they had to come across.
Right.
They had to come across on foot, and they weren't really planning for that.
Right.
And so then it devolved into the way it was in 67, 68, 69 up there around Quezon and Quintien, right, and places like the Rock Pile and so forth.
Yeah. I've read the number of guys who said if Ripley didn't do what he did, I'd have died in Vietnam that week. Because we were screwed, and then they essentially made a move on foot, and then they tried to bounce further west, right? And they got their asses hammed. I mean, you talk about like in the Gulf War, the highway to hell,
right?
That's what happened. Every tank in the world was on that. Was what they call it, Highway 17?
I don't know, but it was like the Ho Chi Minh Trail is really a series of highways, almost dirt highways, and some of them actually graveled, where they were coming down and then jumping off from some of the areas in Laos right into
But we're talking about the main drag that came down the coast.
Street without joy.
Oh, he said that in French. Holy shit.
He said it in French to me.
I know, every once in a while.
No, probably. Yeah, how do you say it in French, man?
La rue sans joie. The street without joy.
That's fucking classy, man.
But I but that's
the street I live on now.
No kidding. What about but when I heard Zinni's, and like I'm a Zinni file, right? And so when he hit the pause button, that's what I thought. Okay, I don't know these things. I've never been to that part of the world, but if that guy's saying that, and I will tell you this, I watched Colin Powell at the UN, and I said, "Is that all we got?" I thought there was supposed to be a smoking gun here.
Yeah.
And I didn't see anything, and I got told by a guy who knew Powell, mm-hmm, that Powell had told Bush, look, the legacy of leaders from Vietnam is we have not allowed our country to go to war and get involved in a war like Vietnam, and where it's a murky, murkily defined mission, blah, 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 and Powell won't do this. That's what I got told the week before he went to the UN. And they said that supposedly the president went to him and said, you're my Secretary of State, I need you and the nation needs you. And Powell rolled over. But
on the other hand,
it wasn't the strongest case I've ever seen be presented for weapons of mass destruction.
After watching those people jumping out of that building in 9/11.
Oh, I agree. But that was, the 9/11 connection to Iraq was bullshit.
No.
I'll tell you right now. I think if we had started in Morocco and started in Malaysia,
what?
And knocked over every fucking Muslim government that was, God himself would call it justice.
Oh, and my God. Yeah. Elvis just left the building, folks.
You know what I mean?
No,
because I'll tell you what, that's what we wanted.
Was a war on Islam, every Islamic nation we would knock over?
Well, you name a good one, and I'll tell you that's one we shouldn't go for. Tell me one where women can vote.
Here's something that's interesting that Jeff is bringing up, Mac. Okay, first off, we're talking about this run-up to the Iraq war, and talking about that with not addressing what went on with this Trump collusion conspiracy, because those are two things that I think the MSN is clearly guilty of when they should have known better, right? Back then they said that they failed because everybody was up for the 2003 invasion, with the exception of Zinni and a few others who knew what they were doing, and to include my dumbass. I wasn't any better. And now you've also got some realities that unfortunately are true with our Islamic neighbors, if you will. There's some realities about Islam that we're flat out friggin' ignoring. And there's going to come a time when they're going to bite us so hard that we're going to go ahead and start entertaining what Jeff is referring to, which is the Carthaginian solution. And it's going to happen because there's no way. I don't see how it doesn't happen, because I don't see how you tamp down the violence associated with the Islamic guys.
I think that's crazy talk. I mean, let me just tell you this. For us, I mean, after our experience in Iraq, right? We're going to do what?
Well, here's the thing, man. I don't think our experience in Iraq was because of how tough the Iraqi resistance was, because our own stupidity.
Stupid in Lebanon, stupid in Vietnam, stupid in Iraq, stupid in Afghanistan. So now let's do stupid again someplace else.
But what I'm saying about that Carthaginian solution and that threat and whatnot is we're talking about out in the future. What we did in Iraq.
We're not Carthage, though. We don't have the balls to be Carthage.
No. We're Rome. The Muslims are Carthage.
No, we're not. We don't have the balls now to do Carthage. I bet before this thing is all said and done, you're going to find something like that. Just get along.
If we had really looked at, because the forensics are there. I mean, even I could tell it with no access to any kind of skiff or, classified material or anything, because at that time I was the director of IOC, but I remember thinking, this is the Saudis, this is a little bit of Egypt, but it's mainly the Saudis and the Pakistanis who are responsible for this.
Which one are we talking about?
We're talking about the attacks on 9/11.
Okay.
Diwali mosques and that kind of bullshit.
Okay.
And we didn't, like Mueller, okay? The first time I heard of this guy was there was anthrax attacks that were almost simultaneous with the 9/11 attacks.
Right.
And they decided, and they had no evidence for this, that it couldn't be a Muslim connection. This had to be weirdo dudes in America doing it. And one of the main reasons was they said, look, we think this anthrax stuff is coming out of Saudi Arabia, and it's Al-Qaeda guys doing it from Saudi Arabia. And Bush said, there's no way. I'm like a brother with the Crown Prince fuckstick or whatever his name is. And so they decided that of all the answers that could be, that's one that couldn't be. That was an Al-Qaeda thing. So they went after these two dudes, scientists who work in America, both of them innocent. One of them commits suicide.
Right.
The other one, we're still paying him like millions of dollars a year in money from a settlement he made when he sued our fucking ass because he was fucking innocent. And Mueller, again, another top-down fucking decision. We're going to go after this guy. And so...
So he got it wrong, all right?
Yes. Yeah.
So he got it wrong.
And also...
And wait, what's the point of all that? What's the final point of that?
The point of that is that we know who the enemy is. We just didn't have the moral courage to go after the right
one. We never do. This is my case. We need to stop going to war because we can't do it as a nation. We suck at it. And history bears that out over and over and over and over.
I don't think so.
Oh, you don't?
I think what happened is this. We because of the type of government we have.
A democracy.
Yeah, democracy, but we got some characteristics of our democracy. First of all, we learned the geniuses who invented this thing realized that democracy could be even a worse tyranny than a monarchy. And so the whole thing we got here, everything from the Electoral College to the House of Representatives and the Senate and the separation of powers and all that stuff, that's masterful, right? The problem is this. When we go into these things lately, they become used as political footballs. I mean, it's always been that way to a certain degree. It was that way back in Rome. The wars were fighting. Why are we doing this? Why are we fighting here? Why are we fighting there?
Yeah, but they didn't. Well, look.
What?
I don't know. I mean, when I look at our ability to apply, war to achieve strategic objectives, since World War II, we suck as a nation.
Yeah, and it's depressing for the human race because there's no one better at it than us.
Right. It's absolutely horrible.
It's all relative, right?
Because the world needs us. And it needs us not to fuck this stuff up. But we do it. And so to me, these really important strategic questions that happen right? It's like we have idiots looking at it. Like, okay, look, we're going to go from hunting Osama bin Laden down to turning Afghanistan and broadening the ground war and doing what?
Yeah.
Do you understand the ramifications of that? If Germany and Japan are 50, 60-year events, Afghanistan is 2,060-year event. Is the American public ready to do that? Because that's how long it's going to take, right?
Well, that was, I have to tell you, because of their myopic fascination with Iraq in 2003, 2002, 2003, and then it became a all-consuming thing till at least 2007 or 8. Afghanistan was actually going pretty good. It was, man. I'll tell you what.
It didn't start going bad until
we started putting shitloads of people in there, thinking that, well, we need a surge in Afghanistan, we had a surge in Iraq. Two totally different conflicts. You were going to say something?
It was. Yeah, I was going to say, because I got in Afghanistan in 2005, and I drove in every province in that country. I mean, with a minuscule small security detail of Afghans. It was everywhere I went. People were glad to see it. Not so much anymore, obviously.
And then we started We started giving battalion commanders battle space. These army battalion, and wherever there is a battle space, soon after followed IEDs, you know, and then ambushes. And then pretty soon the whole thing is in flames because they don't like people driving around telling them what's what. But they did that. I think they did it because they thought this is what's working in, this is working in Iraq, and this is what we're going to do in Afghanistan.
Who the fuck said that? This is what's working in Iraq. Let's do it here.
Why did we go into Helmand Province? What the fuck was the brain power behind that?
I'll tell you what, because we got to go to the Taliban source of money, and that is the that is the opium down there. So it's these fucking geniuses, and they do it, and they do it over and over, and then we get in too deep. And we're like, oh, we got to get out. Okay, we quit. I mean, we won, so now we're leaving. Something like that. Let's go, boys. Let's have a parade. Mission accomplished. What the fuck, man?
Yeah.
We destabilized the whole Middle East and Europe by the fucking... Anyway.
Yeah, it wasn't really what I call a model of stability before we did that.
Well, no, but at least it was more... look, compared then to now, it looked like Sesame Street then.
But the Iraqis would tell you, and I know because I advise them, they'd say that one thing they would say, you know, it's good this guy Saddam did stuff you can't believe to them.
Oh, I know.
And, I agree pretty much. You can't just say, oh, here's a bad guy, we're going to go overthrow him. That's stupid.
Well, and again, so the question, because, okay, he's a bad guy. Got it. Most of them are, for God's sakes. We're the only one that has Pollyanna syndrome. Oh, if you treat your people wrong, you know, then we're going to be upset with you. Most of the world is getting treated like shit. And then we pick and choose. But anyway, all right. when you look at the way we've prosecuted phase four and all these different we go there and we shit hammer people.
Yep.
And then we can't convert that into what we went to war to achieve, and the whole thing blows up on us, and we wind up leaving with young people giving their lives and us not accomplishing our strategic objective. And that's bullshit.
But, you know, it's small decisions. What people consider to be small decisions are really huge decisions. And the decision that we could go and take down, we could dismantle Saddam's government infrastructure and have that same size force and that same type force to, you know, to do transition operations was asinine. And like General Shinseki said, you know, I'm never thinking the guy was a moron when he came up with the idea of berets for the army, you know, but I remember him saying, yeah, you're going to need at least, I'd say, 375,000 or so to, you know, tamp this thing down once we're in there.
Well, that was,
they fired him.
And what Zinni said was, That he took that straight out of the war plan. It's not like we hadn't war planned the shit out of this thing, right? We had, and then Rumsfeld tore it up and he made his own plan.
Yeah, he
and
did.
That's what, and that's what we.
One thing we can all agree on is how much of a genius Donald Rumsfeld wasn't. Absolutely.
The all right. All right. Okay, look, it's time for me to go do my breathing exercises. All right, any
you got to do that you got to do your thing, man, that you talked about in the beginning.
What? My meditation?
Your meditation.
My cross mind?
Right.
I got to do cross mind. The
you got to
cross. But I mean, it's let me tell you, it is depressing. Read H.R. McMaster's book about Vietnam. God, I got halfway through that and I said, I'm not reading this shit. It's too depressing.
Yeah.
You look at what we did in Somalia. We went to Somalia because there was shit on TV that we didn't like. So we went and then we got all these Army Rangers, killed and then we left. We go to Beirut to get between people and blah, blah, and then we get a building dropped on us and then we leave. You know, and it's like you one after the other, and we'd see the propaganda stuff that they put out in Iraq. Hey, keep killing them. Keep shooting them in the head and all their videos. Here's the sixth guy in line to the presidency saying the war is lost. Harry fucking Reid, that piece of shit, right? And so talk about aiding and abetting the enemy, and the only reason Reid said that was to try to win the White House. That's what a piece of shit that guy is. But that was they left Beirut, they left Vietnam, they left Somalia. They will leave here. Punish the Americans. They will leave, right? And you watch it, and then you watch now the way we're groping in Afghanistan, and we're involved in peace talks, and the Afghan government isn't even at the son of a bitch.
Right.
I mean, are you fucking kidding me?
They've never been there.
I have to tell you though. Iraq and Syria is going good for us.
Iraq is about over. When we finally negotiate our withdrawal from Afghanistan, which is clearly the only thing that we're interested in doing, what do you think is going to happen in Afghanistan? All of a sudden, every jihadi in the damn world is going to be wanting to go to Afghanistan to go join with the guys who drove the Americans out. It's going to happen. There's no other way for this whole thing to end.
And let me tell you, to go back to Jeff's comment, it's just like going. It's just like being a kid in grammar school. You want to guarantee that you won't fight very much. Win your fights.
Yeah.
Yep.
Because if you lose your fights, everybody wants a piece of that kid. You win your fights. Could have a peaceful little walk home today, boys, because nobody's screwing with you. And
as like most things, it's not that simple. Even when you're talking about school fights, because I fought my ass off and I won most of them, but it didn't help.
You have issues, though. You were looking for fights, okay? And so you wanted to fight people. And so a normal human that fights when they have to, not fights recreationally like you do.
I didn't like it. I just would say shit, and then I'd insult somebody by accident, and then
By accident.
I'm getting my nose broke by Gary Canavo in front of the high school, age 14.
Well, maybe you should have been a little bit more careful what you said.
Yeah, probably.
Did that ever occur to you?
No.
Hey, let me just tell you, I will leave you with this really cool story. Mike and I are in at 8th and I, and we are there with the CEO of 8th and I is a guy named Don Tomish. Do you know him?
I know him, and I'm not saying anything else.
I don't.
We go in the room where they keep the battle colors of the Marine Corps, and it's a really cool place, right? And off to the side, there's another set of Marine Corps colors that looks different. It looks like it's either quilted different or something. And so Mike and I are standing there, and we're looking like, well, what's that for? And he says, oh, those are the battle colors that were marched into Tokyo after World War II.
Wow.
Exactly.
Whoa.
Mike and I were like, whoa, that's cool. So, anyway. All right, boys, first of all, I appreciate this disjointed, angry discussion today.
It was good.
No, it wasn't. But I feel better. Fuck! Why can't we fucking do anything right, man? Why don't we have it? It really, really, you know. And I heard, you know, Dave Furness talk about, look, you know, between in those two countries, I've had more than 100 Marines killed under my command there.
Right.
And I told their parents that, you know, that we would make sure that their son's sacrifice was not in vain. He said, and now I don't know if what I told him is going to be true.
Yeah. And that's what happens when you work at the tactical level and you get fucked over by what happens at the operational and strategic level.
But you would think at some point we'd figure it the fuck out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they don't have that. It's all pure self-preservation in a political sense.
Right.
And so it's easy to write off.
Well, you want to know something? That's why, though, this whole war powers thing and the president taking us to war without Congress, I think is bullshit. Because then you don't have the continuity that Congress provides, because I run on a platform that I'm going to get us out. And I know I can do that because it's a War Powers Act thing, and I'll pull them out. And if you had to go to Congress, because you have to declare war, Congress would have a healthy debate, and maybe we wouldn't grab the joystick and turn right 90 degrees. Just a
thought. Yeah, I tell you what, I agree. And I think that all be under the border, like the 8th, 2nd Battalion, 8th Marines should be there all over Timmy's yard, guarding us from the great unwashed surging up from the south.
Well, there's actually a reception center one block over from me, and it's right now it's operating at capacity. And I went out, I go over every once in a while. I took some pictures today. You know what it's like when you walk over there, and they've got like at max capacity for migrants. They're all Central Americans. You know what it's like? Nothing. You don't see a soul. That Catholic Relief Charities. Those damn people. They got this thing down into a science. So the buses will pull up. They'll get processed. The buses pick them to the bus station. And they're the same cats that are doing this special visa program for the Afghan Turks, who basically are getting screwed. Almost all of those guys, all the guys I know have ended up in PG County in the projects. And they're like, holy shit, I don't know how to act here. And it's like, dude, this is not a good place for you. And I wonder about that, because you know the perception is there's trash, there's people, they're spilling all over the sidewalks, they're creating havoc. Not down here, brother. It's like a well-oiled machine. It's like watching people processing through recruit training on day one. Boom, boom, boom. Out they go. It's amazing.
Illegal.
With that, Jeff, any parting words for us? Any parting words of wisdom?
Only to say that it appears that the head of the Gambino family was killed by his daughter's boyfriend.
What?
Yes.
Get out.
Yeah. This guy, he was a MAGA guy. He flashed a MAGA sign at his arraignment. And he is not a mob guy. He was pissed off because he's having problems with a girl, and he manifests himself with him smashing his vehicle into the mob boss of the Gambino family's his car. Guy came down, and the mob guy calmed him down. They shook hands, but he got pissed again and shot him from behind. And if the mafia doesn't kill that guy, then they really have atrophied.
They've atrophied? We'll all keep our fingers crossed and hope the mafia hasn't atrophied.
I mean, I know it, man. It's like, you'd see... Francis Ford Coppola shedding a tear. This guy, you know, this guy.
No, he's actually, he's rubbing his hands together because he sees a new movie.
Yeah, really.
He sees economic opportunity.
This guy didn't have any bodyguards, went out there and said, look, man.
Yeah.
You know, he's pissed about, and so he got shot from, but if they don't, they took care of Whitey Bulger, some pissed off Italian dude, beat him to death with a lock. I mean, like a lock from your locker.
I think he's going to shit on his voices. We're going up. I think that's what's going on.
Yeah.
All right. Wait, with all those pearls of wisdom right there, pick wisely. Jeff Kenny and Tim Lynch. Man, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
There you go.
Thank you, Max.
More of Armory Radio coming up next.